For our guests here today, my name is Clay Barnes, and I am the executive pastor here for about 35 more days, 4 hours, but who's counting? We are continuing today in our series of Unlikely. If you're our guest here with us, we've been looking at stories, people in the Bible who are unlikely, who God uses in ways that you go, it makes no sense. How does this person fit? It's improbable at best that this person should be in the Bible, let alone a serious character of the Bible. So we're beginning. I want you to see our definition. Let me go back. Definition of unlikely. Improbable. I love that definition. These are people who are improbable to succeed. Likely to fail. These are people likely to fail that we're looking at. Uncompromising, holding to little prospects of success, and they're unpromising in all that they do. These are the people that God chooses in not only unlikely people, but in unlikely stories. So today we're looking at an unlikely book in a lot of senses, and this is the book of Ruth. If you're not familiar where Ruth is, it's right after Joshua and Judges and right before 1 Samuel. So right in there, it's stuck in there, four little chapters, but an amazing book. Now, this book is unlikely for several reasons. There are two main storylines that we're going to look at and how they're connected. But let me give you a brief backstory to where we are in history. Right now, we are about 100 to 150 years before the unlikely character of King David. All right, we are in this place known as the period of the judges. The thing takes place maybe 100 years before David takes over. It's likely written, though we're not certain with this, the author is likely writing this book about 200 or so years after the events. So somewhere toward the end of the reign of King Solomon, maybe even into the next reign. Now, the author gives us absolutely no hint who he or she might be. There's just no hint. There's nothing in here that tells us who this author is. They're not interested in us knowing. So Israel is one nation in the period of the judges. They're surrounded on all sides by enemies, including the land of Moab, that's going to play into our story in a minute. Now, during this time that the story takes place, there's a famine that's overcome the land of Israel, and it's been around for a while. So we find out, and we pick up the story in the prologue. So if you have your Bible, open up to Ruth, again, right after Judges, right before 1 Samuel, or turn on to Ruth. And we have the prologue, and we have a story about a man, his wife, and his two sons, who are not trusting that God is going to be sufficient to help them out of the famine they're in, and so they travel to a foreign land, an enemy land. So we read in 1:1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn to the country of Moab, he, his wife, his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife, Naomi, and the name of his two sons was Machlon and Chilion. They were Ephratites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and then both Machlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. So that's the backstory. They leave Israel, they go to Moab, the sons marry Moabite women, Elimelech dies, and they're in the country about 10 years. And then the two sons die. So why Ruth? Why are we picking this as part of our unlikely series? Well, there are a couple reasons that I want you to grab. The first is the very story itself, the title, the very issue of the story is unlikely. It is improbable at best. Now, by improbable, I don't mean it didn't happen. It's a historical story. These are real people. But it's so improbable how it comes about. Secondly, the characters in the book are improbable people, that they would be elevated into what we call our scriptures today. And thirdly, this unlikely, improbable story points us to another very unlikely and improbable story. So first, why is the story itself, or the very title of the book of Ruth, improbable or unlikely? It's twofold. One, Ruth is a woman. And there's only one other book in all of the scripture that's named after a woman, and she was queen. So you've got a woman, but you don't just have a woman, you have a Moabite, an enemy of Israel. Now, the author makes no attempt to shield Ruth's ethnicity or her station in life, and the people of that day would hate the Moabites. They hated the Moabites because several hundred years before, Moabite came into existence by an incestuous relationship between Lot, remember the story of Abraham and Lot, between Lot and his oldest daughter, had a son named Moab. Moab became the father of the nation of Moab. So he's born in an incestuous relationship. A couple hundred years later, the people are wandering in the wilderness, they're fleeing Egypt, and they come up to the land of Moab and they ask to cross Moab to be able to get into the promised land. And Moab refuses. As a result of that refusal, Israel struggles for another series of years in the wilderness with much more heartbreak and heartache. And they hated Moab for it. So not only the readers of not only the people of the day, but the readers reading a couple hundred years later still hated Moab. So it's unlikely that an author would choose a woman and a Moabite. But here's the second reason that this title is so unlikely. Ruth is not even the main character in our story. Naomi is the main character. If you recognize in those first verses I read, the story isn't about Ruth and her mother-in-law. The story is about Naomi and her daughter-in-laws. In fact, in Hebrew literary culture, you determined a person's importance and the character's importance by the amount of dialogue they have in the story. Well, Ruth has the third most dialogue in the story, behind Naomi and Boaz. So she's not even the main character. And yet the book, the author chooses to label and call this book the Book of Ruth. Now, because Naomi is the main character, there's a theme that overarches this book, and it is this: from bitterness to fullness. From bitterness towards God to fullness from God. From lost and hopeless to redeemed. It is one of the most powerful pictures of redemption that we have in the Bible. One other important point about Ruth that you may not know is that Ruth is one of two books that is read in its entirety during the Jewish festival of Shavuot, or what we would know as Pentecost, the Feast of Weeks. During Shavuot, Ruth is read in its entirety. Why? Because it is considered, along with the Torah, the book in the Bible that shows the extraordinary kindness of God. The extraordinary kindness of God. Or, if you were here last week, the chesed of God. Chesed. An incredibly powerful word. Now, if you pronounce that as chesed, or you drop the C and pronounce it as chesed, you're not pronouncing it correctly. If you're not probably spitting on the person in front of you, you're not really pronouncing it correctly. It's chesed. This is an incredibly powerful word. It is used 234 times in the Old Testament, and it cannot be captured by one single English word. It actually is a strongly relational word that's built around a series of concepts. All attributes of God, all those positive attributes of God. So, in the Old Testament, it is variously translated as love, kindness, grace, mercy, favor, goodness, loving kindness. And it is a word that means this: it is a giving of kindness or grace or mercy with absolutely no expectation of anything in return. It is selfless kindness. It is selfless giving. It is selfless love. It is selfless goodness. No expectation of return. That's the word. It's an action word. Last week, Pastor Alex introduced this word in the story of David and Mephibosheth. You remember the story, if you were here, of David's incredible kindness, his chesed, towards this son of one of his close friends. However, I want you to understand, there is no book in the Bible more than the book of Ruth that shows the overwhelming, extraordinary kindness or chesed of God than this little book, this four-chapter book called Ruth. It's one of the two major themes, is the chesed, the kindness of God. It's introduced first by Naomi in chapter 1, verse 8. So we read this: she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law. They went away to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, "Go, return each to your mother's house. May the Lord deal with chesed, deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and me." So Naomi introduces this concept, go, that the Lord will deal with you kindly. Now, I'll tell you, she doesn't know what she's talking about right here, and we're going to come to that in our second theme, and you'll understand why. In verses 16 and 17 of this same chapter 1, we see chesed expressed by Ruth. But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more if anything but death parts me from you." Do you hear the chesed? She's not asking anything in return. Nothing in return. I am going with you, regardless of what the outcome is, regardless of the fact that we are going to return to absolute poverty and absolute destituteness, if that's a word. We're returning. It doesn't matter. I'm going with you. In chapter 2, verses 8 to 12, we see Boaz expressing chesed. Verse 8, "Then Boaz said to Ruth, 'Now listen, my daughter, do not go and glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young woman.'" Now he's talking to a Moabite, a hated woman of Israel. "Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn.' Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground. She said, 'Why have I found chesed in your eyes? Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?' But Boaz answered her, 'All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, how you left your father and mother, your native land, and came to a people you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and the full reward that has said from God be given to you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge.'" In verse 20 of chapter 2, in verse 20, you see Naomi again expressing chesed. "And Naomi said to her daughter, 'May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness," the Lord's kindness, the Lord's chesed, "has not forsaken the living or the dead." In chapter 3, verse 1, we're going to come back to this verse with our second theme, but look at it right now. "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may go well for you? Should I not be invested in seeking your rest and your health?'" Chesed. In chapter 3, verse 10. Now, if you've read the book of Ruth, You know, chapter 3 is an oddly strange chapter. There's a strange event that takes place that we do not have a chance to cover in the gist of this sermon. Let me just say this. The people of Boaz's day and the readers a couple hundred years later would understand the symbolism of the event. It was a sexual event, but it was one done with integrity. We don't get it. It doesn't make a lot of sense for us, uncovering feet and covering feet with your cloak, but they would have gotten it. Just take that. So in chapter 3, verse 10, Boaz says this, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last chesed, kindness, greater than the first, in that you have not gone after other young men, whether poor or rich." Boaz is clearly not a young man. And when it says young men, it's not referring just to age. It's referring to vitality and to looks. So Boaz is probably old and not real good looking. And yet, she offers him kindness, and Boaz does it. Finally, in chapter 4, the townspeople express chesed. Then the woman said to Naomi, this is after Ruth and Boaz gave birth, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer, a chesed of life, and a nourisher of your old age." Chesed, that great grace, blessing, goodness, love, mercy. You see, chesed is modeled throughout the book of Ruth by Boaz. How do we know that? First, he accepts as a worker a Moabite destitute woman. Against all of what Israel would stand for, he accepts her. Then he accepts her in a night vigil. And finally, he accepts her as his own wife. An incredible picture of the redemptive nature of chesed. The redemptive nature. Chesed is seen throughout the Bible, and it shows us this. First, God works in mysterious, improbable, and unlikely ways to see all of the purposes that God has planned worked out. God works in mysterious ways. In all things, as Romans 8:28 says, God works for the good, the Greek translation of the Hebrew chesed. God works for good for all of those who are called according to God's purpose. And thirdly, God's grace, chesed, knows no boundaries. That even a destitute Moabite woman will now be included in the royal line. Not only the royal line, but the messianic line of Jesus has Moabite blood in it. That is incredible, and that is improbable. Now, there's a second theme that's completely different, and it might sound like opposite. You've got this chesed, this great blessing, this great redemption, but there's a second theme in the book of Ruth that I want you to see. And it is the theme of grief and the process of grief. I would challenge you that the author of this book is very acquainted with the process of grief and walks us through grief through the character of Naomi. A lot of you are familiar with a book that was written 50 years ago by Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. It's a book called On Grief and Grieving. And it has been used for the last 50 years in almost every training experience anybody has in learning how to walk people through grief. What Kubler-Ross does in this book is that she sets out the 5 stages of grief that anybody goes through when they have a significant loss, when a loved one has died. And she sets out these 5 stages, and she says that basically everybody goes through this, and I agree. And so she says after the death, the first stage that people go through is denial. And it's this numbness, this sense of this isn't happening to me. This is not happening to me right now. And it's I think, at times a God-given numbness just to survive the first 72 hours. But it's a denial. After the denial doesn't work anymore, people often move to an anger stage, a protest stage. How dare this be happening to me? How could this situation have happened? Even anger at God. God, how dare you do this to me? And I've even seen anger at the person who died. How could you leave me like this? How could you leave me in this situation? After anger, because that's such an intense feeling, we often see this bargaining stage. This is where people are trying to plan how to get out of this grief, how to get out of the intensity that I'm feeling right now. And so that we try to plan for other people or plan for ourselves. We try to bargain and make bargains with other people and make bargains with God so that we can be set free. When we find out that doesn't work real well, we move to the fourth stage, and that is depression, a sense of hopelessness, helplessness. And this is the hardest stage for many people to help someone walk through. They're in a place of just utter despair. How is life going to mean anything to me? And as they work through that stage, as they work through that, and only working through those stages, can they come to the fifth stage, where there's now acceptance of the death and there's the ability to reattach, whether that's attaching to a new spouse or it's attaching to children, to grandchildren, whatever it is. Now, Kubler-Ross put it out in this linear fashion. And I almost wish I could say it worked that way, so that in the midst of grief, you would know, okay, right now I'm in the bargaining stage, so I know I've got this and this to go through. Kubler-Ross said this stage takes a minimum of a year. This whole process takes a minimum of a year. And you've heard people say, you have to get through all the anniversaries, all the birthdays, all of the holidays in order to process through this. But I don't think it works this way. I've been around grief for a long time and in my own life, and I think grief works more like this. You see it? Grief isn't nice and neat and clean. And we're in and out of these different stages of anger and depression and bargaining and denial, numbness and anger. And depression, and bargaining, and depression, over and over and over again, which can be frustrating to caregivers until we are able to reattach, to redefine it. But you know what? Kubler-Ross just kind of put this on paper. She didn't create these. In fact, the author of the book of Ruth takes the readers through the stages of grief, through these stages, and I want you to see this. So, stage one, that numbness, that denial. Ruth chapter 1, verse 8. But Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and me. The Lord grant that you may find rest." She doesn't know what she's talking about. They had nowhere to go back to because they had married Israelites in Moab. They would have been hated. Going forward into Israel, they'd have been hated because they were Moabites. There was nowhere for them to go. Naomi does not know what she's talking about. She's just numb. And just go home. Go home and get married. I'm going to go on. I've got nothing to take you through. And then we see the anger. Read a little bit further in verse 13 and verse 20 and 21. "Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter for me, for your sake, that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." And here's the rage. Here is the anger. "And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, 'Is this Naomi?' She said to them, 'Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara,'" bitter. "Call me Mara, for the Lord Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full. The Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" Do you hear the rage? Do you hear the anger? It's real. And it's what we go through. Chapter 2, verses 20, we see the next stage. Some of the common aspects of bargaining, trying to figure a way out. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Now she's referring to herself as the dead. Naomi also said, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Ruth, the Moabite, said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all the harvest.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be salted." She's trying to take care of it, trying to get it fixed. Chapter 3, verse 1. We read this before, but I want you to see how the two themes come together. "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, shall I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were?'" Do you hear the word? It's subtle, but I need you to hear the word. "Is it not good for rest for you? Is it not good for you?" Notice it's not us. Naomi has no future. There is no future for her in this story at this point. And she is resigned to the hopeless and helpless situation. She is in desperate need of somebody to redeem this situation. And then finally, the end of chapter 4, we find out that Boaz and Ruth are married and they have a son, and the women say this. "Then the women said to Naomi," notice they didn't say it to Ruth. Here's the author shifting us away from Ruth over to Naomi. "The women said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer.'" You have met a redeemer. You have needed, you are hopeless, and God sent a redeemer. "They bore a son. His name will be renowned." Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and became his nurse. The ability to attach. Now, this is well after a year of them coming back, because we find out at the end of chapter 1, they came back at the beginning of the harvest. The harvest itself takes 3 months, and then to get married after that, and then have a baby, and then 9 months. So we're clearly into this, at the minimum, the second year. And she's finally able to attach. Hesed, God's blessing, and grief together in the same story. Folks, these are not opposites. I like to view them as the two sides of the same coin, and what holds them together is the kinsman redeemer. What's a kinsman redeemer? The word literally means someone of like us who redeems us. Someone who is like us. A man redeemed this utterly unredeemable situation, and Ruth and Naomi receive the redemption. In our story, it's Boaz who is the kinsman redeemer. The author of Ruth, writing likely 200 years or so later, tells his or her readers that it's the same Lord, the same Yahweh who redeemed Israel from these times with his chesed, with God's blessing. God redeemed Israel and raised up this unlikely person named David and held that line together through incredibly unlikely and improbable places. All these years later, what the author probably did not know, and in the providence and in the grace of God, is that several hundred years later, an unlikely announcement would be made to a young virgin about another kinsman redeemer. A man who did not regard equality with God something to be clung to, but emptied himself. An unlikely story that would unfold in great joy and in great sorrow. A story that we continue to remember and celebrate today. The incredible chesed of God stepping in and being in full display in the joy of a manger, the heartbreak of a cross and a grave, and the joy of an empty tomb. The chesed of God in great grief, joy and grief coming together. And what does this story tell us today? It tells us this. Every person in this room is Ruth. We're all Ruths. We're all outcast in desperate need of somebody to redeem us. We are outcast from God. And we are all Naomis. We are all lost in our grief without a redeemer. But God demonstrates his chesed towards us in that while we were yet sinners, the kinsman redeemer died. The chesed of God. And we celebrate that. We are Ruth and we are Naomi. And we have a kinsman redeemer. And his name is Jesus. I'm going to open up the prayer altar benches. We've just come through the day known as Thanksgiving. And I want to give you an opportunity, if you would like. You could come forward and if you want to pray and thank God if you know Kinsman Redeemer. To thank God for that Kinsman Redeemer. Maybe you're in a grief place or you have a family member or a close friend who is really, really struggling right now and you want to pray for them to know the chesed of God in the midst of that grief. I invite you to come and pray. We're going to take a few moments to pray before we move into the Lord's table. Right after our service, if you have need of even more prayer, our elders will gather in the prayer room. And right after this service, I want to encourage you to go and to be a part and let the elders pray over you. But right now, if you would like to join me, if you're good with praying on your own, just keep your hands down. If you would like somebody to pray for you or for a situation, just have your hands up, and one of our prayer team will pray. Let's go to Lord in prayer.